11th. In these preceding 10 sections, we've been dealing with an age of division, of separated nationalities. We've already described this period of the 17th and 18th centuries as an interregnum in the progress of mankind towards a worldwide unity. Throughout this period, there was no ruling, unifying idea in men's minds. The impulse of the empire had failed until the emperor was no more than one of a number of competing princes, and the dream of Christendom also was a fading dream. The developing powers jostled one another throughout the world, but for a time it seemed that they might jostle one another indefinitely without any great catastrophe to mankind. The great geographical discoveries of the 16th century had so enlarged human resources that, for all their divisions, for all the waste of their wars and policies, the people of Europe enjoyed a considerable and increasing prosperity. Central Europe recovered steadily from the devastation of the 30 Years' War. Looking back upon this period, which came to its climax in the 18th century, looking back, as we can begin to do nowadays, and seeing its events in relation to the centuries that came before it, and to the great movements of the present time, we're able to realize how transitory and provisional were its political forms, and how unstable its securities. Provisional it was, as no other age has been provisional, an age of assimilation and recuperation, a political pause, a gathering up of the ideas of men and the resources of science for a wider human effort. But the contemporary mind didn't see it in that light. The failure of the great creative ideas, as they had been formulated in the Middle Ages, had left human thought for a time destitute of the guidance of creative ideas. Even educated and imaginative men saw the world undramatically, no longer as an interplay of effort and destiny, but as the scene in which a trite happiness was sought and the milder virtues were rewarded. It wasn't simply the contented and conservative-minded who, in a world of rapid changes, were under the sway of this assurance of an achieved fixity of human conditions. Even highly critical and insurgent intelligences, in default of any sustaining movements in the soul of the community, betrayed the same disposition. Political life, they felt, had ceased to be the urgent and tragic thing it had once been. It had become a polite comedy. The 18th was a century of comedy, which at the end grew grim. It's inconceivable that that world of the middle 18th century could have produced a Jesus of Nazareth, a Gautama, a Francis of Assisi, an Ignatius of Loyola. If one may imagine an 18th century John Huss, it's impossible to imagine anyone with sufficient passion to burn him. Until the stirrings of conscience in Britain that developed into the Methodist revival began, we can detect scarcely a suspicion that there still remained great tasks in hand for our race to do, that enormous disturbances were close at hand, or that the path of man through space and time was dark with countless dangers and must, to the end, remain a high and terrible enterprise. We've quoted again and again in this history from Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Now we shall quote from it for the last time and bid it farewell, for we've come to the age in which it was written. Gibbon was born in 1737, and the last volume of his history was published in 1787, but the passage we shall quote was probably written in the year 1780. Gibbon was a young man of delicate health and fairly good fortune. He had a partial and interrupted education at Oxford, and then he completed his studies in Geneva. On the whole, his outlook was French and cosmopolitan rather than British, and he was much under the intellectual influence of that great Frenchman who is best known under the name of Voltaire, François-Marie Henriot de Voltaire, 1694-1778. Voltaire was an author of enormous industry. 70 volumes of him adorn the present writer's shelves, and another edition of Voltaire's works runs to 94. He dealt largely with history and public affairs, and he corresponded with Catherine the Great of Russia, Frederick the Great of Prussia, Louis XV, and most of the prominent people of the time. Both Voltaire and Gibbon had the sense of history strong in them. Both have set out very plainly and fully their visions of human life, and it's clear that to both of them the system in which they lived, the system of monarchy, of leisurely and privileged gentlefolks, of rather despised industrial and trading people, and of downtrodden and negligible labourers and poor and common people, seemed the most stably established way of living that the world has ever seen. They postured a little as republicans, and sneered at the divine pretensions of monarchy, but the republicanism that appealed to Voltaire was the crowned republicanism of the Britain of those days, in which the king was simply the official head, the first and greatest of the gentlemen. The ideal they sustained was the ideal of a polite and polished world, in which men, men of quality, that is, for no others counted, would be ashamed to be cruel or gross or enthusiastic, in which the appointments of life would be spacious and elegant, and the fear of ridicule, the potent auxiliary of the law in maintaining the decorum and harmonies of life. Voltaire had in him the possibility of a passionate hatred of injustice, and his interventions on behalf of persecuted or ill-used men are the highlights of his long and complicated life story. And this being the mental disposition of Gibbon and Voltaire, and of the age in which they lived, it's natural that they should find the existence of religion in the world, and in particular the existence of Christianity, a perplexing and rather unaccountable phenomenon. The whole of that side of life seemed to them a kind of craziness in the human makeup. Gibbon's great history is essentially an attack upon Christianity as the operating cause of the decline and fall. He idealized the crude and gross plutocracy of Rome into a world of fine gentlemen upon the 18th century model, and told how it fell before the barbarian from without because of the decay through Christianity within. In our history here, we've tried to set that story in a better light. To Voltaire, official Christianity was la femme, something that limited people's lives, interfered with their thoughts, persecuted harmless dissentients. And indeed, in that period of the interregnum, there was very little life or light in either the Orthodox Christianity of Rome or in the Orthodox tame churches of Russia and of the Protestant princes. In an interregnum incommoded with an abundance of sleek parsons and sly priests, it was hard to realize what fires had once blazed in the heart of Christianity, and what fires of political and religious passion might still blaze in the hearts of men. At the end of his third volume, Gibbon completed his account of the breaking up of the Western Empire. He then raised the question whether civilization might ever undergo again a similar collapse. This led him to review the existing state of affairs in 1780 and to compare it with the state of affairs during the decline of Imperial Rome. It'll be very convenient to our general design to quote some passages from that comparison here. For nothing could better illustrate the state of mind of the liberal thinkers of Europe at the crest of the political interregnum of the age of the great powers, before the first intimations of those profound political and social forces of disintegration that have produced at length the dramatic interrogations of our own times. "This awful revolution," wrote Gibbon of the Western collapse, "may be usefully applied to the useful instruction of the present age. It's the duty of a patriot to prefer and promote the exclusive interest and glory of his native country, but a philosopher may be permitted to enlarge his views, and to consider Europe as one great republic, whose various inhabitants have attained almost the same level of politeness and cultivation. The balance of power will continue to fluctuate, and the prosperity of our own or the neighboring kingdoms may be alternately exalted or depressed. but these partial events can't essentially injure our general state of happiness, the system of arts and laws and manners, which so advantageously distinguish above the rest of mankind the Europeans and their colonies.